Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This summer, historians, history buffs, and war reenactors will flock to places like Gettysburg and Vicksburg for the sesquicentennial of these turning point battles during the U.S. Civil War. But another anniversary is passing largely unnoticed. This year continues the bicentennial of the War of 1812 between Great Britain and the young United States, war in which the U.S. lost most of the battles, yet won the war, at least in the sense that this conflict cleared the way for the settlement of a continental United States. This was the war that gave us our national anthem, and the defense of Baltimore's Fort McHenry did more than give us a national song. It saved the nation, according to my guest today. Steve Vogel is a national reporter for the Washington Post who's reported extensively on military affairs and the treatment of veterans from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. He is the author of Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. It's published by Random House. In it, he recounts the British efforts to conclude the war in the summer of 1814 with the attack and burning of our capital, Washington, D.C., and how the defense of Baltimore preserved our nation's future and gave us a national emblem, the Star-Spangled Banner. Steve Vogel joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Steve Vogel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
We've kind of been in the last couple of years on this sort of anniversary kick of conflicts, U.S. conflicts, and we think of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. I don't think very many people think of the bicentennial of the War of 1812. Of course, it was a horrible war. The United States only escaped through the skin of its teeth from, I don't know what would have happened if the British would have won the war, but why don't we remember the War of 1812?
You know, it's funny because the War of 1812 was very prominent in the American consciousness through much of the 19th century. You know, certainly the generations that were brought up after that war, considered it a war that had really firmly established American independence and sovereignty. And then, of course, the Civil War was such an overwhelming, transcendent experience for Americans. And I think the War of 1812 kind of got lost in the shuffle and has been more or less overlooked ever since.
Of course, the War of 1812 involved the United States invading Canada. It ended after the peace in New Orleans with a decisive American victory by Andrew Jackson defending New Orleans. And, of course, we remember it for the burning of Washington and what happened at Baltimore just a few weeks later when Fort McHenry stood and we got a national anthem out of it. I think just for that reason we should remember the war, the fact that, you know, our national anthem came from the War of 1812.
That's true. And what we sometimes forget, though, is that those circumstances that brought about the national anthem, it truly was a time when the United States was teetering in terms of continuing as this free, new, young democracy in the Western Hemisphere. We were on the verge of kind of losing everything, having the Union fall apart and seeing our options for moving out to the West kind of stopped by the British. So it was a very decisive moment in American history.
And some historians believe that we sort of blundered into the war. You had the French and the English fighting, you know, the Napoleonic Wars, and we were sort of on the sidelines. We had some that favored the French. We had others that favored the British. And did we play both sides against each other?
Well, we were more or less a country that was being tossed in the turmoil of that war. These were two of the giants, certainly in Europe and really in the whole world, Great Britain, the dominant naval power, and Napoleon, had dominated much of continental Europe. And this titanic war was having ripples around the globe. And the United States, as a result, was having its trade blocked by the British, who didn't want the United States trading with France or much of continental Europe. And our ships were being stopped at sea by British ships. And sailors taken from our ships and impressed into service for the Royal Navy. They were very short on manpower for this in this huge war. And I think in some ways it was the United States was trying to assert its sovereignty as an independent nation, and Great Britain and France really couldn't care less about our rights as a nation and were quite willing to trample on our sovereignty in order to pursue this far greater conflict that they were involved in.
So in many ways it was sort of a war of choice.
For the United States, absolutely. This was our first war of choice. Great Britain did not choose to fight this war. We, the United States, declared war on Great Britain. That's something we tend to overlook. And it was a very, very divided country at that time. By no means was there an overwhelming national push to go to war. It was very divided along regional lines. And primarily some of the states, our new states to the west at that time, like Kentucky, where they were more concerned with British transgressions on the western borders that were pushing for war, and parts of the south. New England staunchly opposed this war, just afraid of messing up whatever seafaring commerce it still had. So the vote for this war was the closest in American history when Congress decided to declare war in June of 1812.
Your book focuses on the 6 weeks in the summer of 1814 when Washington was burned, when the British came up the Patuxent River around the Chesapeake and went across Maryland and burned Washington, and then later tried to do the same thing to Baltimore, which was, I guess, the Washington, obviously, the capital, but Baltimore, a key port.
Yes, you know, this was a good 2 years into the war. The War of 1812, we sometimes forget that it went on for almost 3 years, sort of a poor choice of names for this war. But in 1814, the conditions suddenly turned pretty sour for the United States. It hadn't been going that well to start with. Our multiple invasions of Canada had failed. And we'd hoped to take the Canadian colonies to use as a bargaining chip with Great Britain. But in 1814, Napoleon abdicated, and that freed up the British to begin sending some of these troops and ships that had been tied up in fighting France over to the United States to put an end to this war. And the Chesapeake region was one of the areas that they chose to put some pressure on the United States to divert American attacks into Canada.
Now, you tell the story through a couple of key figures, Francis Scott Key, for one, but the British side is told through, not necessarily the overall leader of the naval force of the British, but he was perhaps the one best known to Americans. His name was Rear Admiral George Cockburn. And Cockburn was fighting a version of total war 50 years before General Sherman marched through the South and down to Atlanta and sort of introduced that term of total war. He was burning towns. He was taking private property. And this was sort of a new thing in warfare, wasn't it?
Well, it was new for a lot of the folks in the Chesapeake anyway. They, you know, until Cockburn arrived on the scene in 1813, there was a British historian who happened to be in America at the time war broke out. He said, until George Cockburn showed up, people in the Chesapeake would have only known by hearsay that there was a war going on. And Cockburn was determined to undercut the American public support for the war, and he thought the way to do this would be to take the war to American commerce, to the people who were living along the waters of the Chesapeake that he could reach pretty easily. And he launched a campaign of terror both in 1813, exactly 200 years ago, and then with a larger force in 1814, once some of these reinforcements were being sent to America. Cockburn then had the opportunity to do more than just raids. And he, at his urging, he was a very aggressive commander. At his urging, his superiors began to consider an attack on the capital of the United States, Washington.
He was a very flamboyant person, very boastful. I think a newspaper man like yourself would say he made good copy.
That's absolutely right, Rich. He, in fact, you know, the American papers at the time described him in most unflattering terms, you know, the Red Devil of the Chesapeake and, you know, modern-day Attila the Hun. His escapades really earned him quite a bit of notoriety around the country, particularly in the Chesapeake. And he was, by 1814, the most feared and the most hated man in America. And now he was in a position to really up the ante.
There's some interesting things I learned in this book. One was that there was a lot of contact between Americans and British. I mean, American agents would come in contact, and there was sort of, I guess, this gentlemanly thing going on where, okay, we're not going to war right now. We'll meet, we'll dine, we'll talk. And then, you know, a lot of times he was actually getting his message out to sort of inspire fear. But I found that really interesting.
Right. You know, both sides, for the most part, were conducting the war on, you know, somewhat gentlemanly terms. And that wasn't unusual for the time frame. And, you know, particularly the United States having come out of England, there were a lot of ties between the Royal Navy folks from England who were over here and Americans. And a lot of Americans at the time didn't necessarily wholeheartedly consider themselves Americans. You know, we kind of forget that there had been quite a few loyalists during the American Revolution, and not everybody had thought it was such a great idea to break off from Great Britain, and a lot of those folks were still around, and a lot of people felt ties to Great Britain, and in parts of Maryland where the British were operating, the population was often sympathetic to Great Britain and, you know, provided quite a bit of intelligence and goods to help the British.
In fact, at the very beginning of the book, you write of Francis Scott Key writing, I believe it was a sort of relative of some sort who had been in Congress. He'd been a loyalist. He'd left. He'd come back and served in Congress. And, you know, I found that interesting. I thought most of the loyalists who really were unhappy after the war left and never came back. But a number did come back.
That's right. That was Key's uncle, Philip Barton Key, who was had a profound influence on young Francis during his schooling and early career as an attorney in Washington. And Francis Scott Key's father was a great patriot who had fought with George Washington, and his brother had gone to England after the war, but then come back, and Francis Key's father welcomed him, you know, with open arms and shared the family inheritance and so forth. So yes, absolutely, there were a lot of divided loyalties at that time.
Now, we think of Francis Scott Key because he wrote the Star-Spangled Banner as must have been an uber-patriot of the time. Who was Francis Scott Key?
Well, he was a Washington lawyer. That's sort of a pejorative term these days. but, you know, he'd grown up in Maryland and attended school in Annapolis, and he had established a practice in the new American capital along with his uncle, the former Loyalist, and by the time the War of 1812 came around, he'd been in practice for about 6 or 7 years, and he was becoming one of the most prominent attorneys in town. He'd been involved in a couple of important cases before the Supreme Court, but he was profoundly opposed to this war, like many in the country. Really, half the country was against it, and he, was appalled that the United States would attack Canada or the Canadian colonies, which he viewed as innocent third parties in this whole conflict. And in fact, he writes a letter to his good friend John Randolph of Virginia after an American invasion into Quebec had failed. And he told Randolph, you know, some may call me a traitor, but if this be treason, I embrace it because I'm happy that, you know, the American attack failed. And it's kind of ironic that he would end up writing this most patriotic of songs, because he had grave doubts about the wisdom or justice of this war.
And we have to think of the two different aims of the two countries. I think there was a portion of the United States, the War Hawks, Henry Clay in Kentucky, and you mentioned the faction in Kentucky that were really for this war. They thought that this might be a great chance to swallow up Canada, didn't they?
Yeah, I think there were certainly aspirations for increasing American territory. And, you know, whether they wanted to swallow up Canada, I'm sure there were certainly some Americans that wanted that. Now, Madison, James Madison, the president, supported these attacks into Canada primarily as a bargaining chip to force Great Britain to take the American grievances seriously. And so whether that territory would have ended up as part of the United States is pure speculation at this point. But there were certainly many many Americans who would have been happy to have the Canadian territory to add to the United States. But the primary interest was in ensuring that the United States had an open route to the West, to Western expansion, and certainly British North America, as Canada was referred to at the time, represented a threat to that. And we wanted to make sure that you know, the United States had was not the weak sister on the Western frontier.
And on the other hand, the British, I think most Americans assumed the War of 1812 was an attempt to regain the United States. I don't think that was the case from my reading of your book.
That's right. That's kind of a misconception that we have today. But at the same time, once the United States declared war, Great Britain, country which really viewed this war as an act of treachery, they were off fighting Napoleon to save the world, and the United States had stabbed them in the back. They were pretty determined to make sure the United States was not left in a position to do something like this again. So they would have been quite happy to see the Union collapse. Certainly some of the commanders were hoping to leave the United States in a condition where, you know, our government, we might split apart. There was a movement in New England, in fact, to secede from the United States. And Great Britain made these demands, some of the peace negotiations that were underway in 1814, that would essentially have left them dominant in North America, including complete military control of the Great Lakes, navigation rights on the Mississippi, and the creation of an enormous buffer state that would be turned over to the Native American Indian tribes that would have encompassed parts of 7 American states today in the old Northwest, you know, Michigan and Indiana, all that territory out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, there was another interesting fact that I learned, that the British used what they called colonial marines. These were escaped slaves who had made their way to Canada, who had enlisted to fight against the United States. And Coburn used this in the Chesapeake, and I can imagine in slaveholding Maryland and Virginia, this was a scary force.
Yeah, it was a very brilliant move by the British to put the escaped slaves to use like this, not just because of the additional manpower and scouting intelligence that these former slaves were able to provide, but just because of the sheer terror that it left in the plantations and many of the communities in the tidewater areas of Virginia and Maryland, where the militia was more or less afraid to leave their homes because they feared that their own slaves would rise against them or would flee to the British. And this was one of the reasons the United States was so ineffective in challenging the British in the Chesapeake region, just because it was hard to muster enough force to attack the British and to defend Washington. And so these this corps of colonial marines, as the British call them, proved to be a very effective weapon.
My guest today is Steve Vogel, a national reporter for The Washington Post and the author of the previous book, The Pentagon. His new book is Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. And it tells the story of the burning and sacking of Washington, and then, of course, the later events at Baltimore's Fort McHenry, which gave us the Star-Spangled Banner, thanks to Francis Scott Key. Let's talk quickly about the burning of Washington. Coburn, operating the Chesapeake, his goal was to actually destroy Washington, and he pretty much did that. We remember the story of Dolly Madison grabbing the portrait of George Washington and fleeing. James Madison, the president, actually had strapped on guns and sort of almost was going to go to war.
Right. Yeah. He rode out to the battle area outside of Washington in the town of Bladensburg, Maryland, where forces were more or less concentrating. And at the last minute, as the British were approaching, and it seemed clear that the battle was going to take place, Madison rode out there and almost stumbled into enemy lines. He passed the American lines without realizing it and came close to being captured at that point, and then retreated a bit and ends up having rockets fired over his head. So we kind of, in today's world, it's hard to imagine, but our president was very close to being captured or killed or wounded in this battle.
And that symbolized our defense of the Capitol. It was pretty shoddy affair. The British marched right in and burned all the public buildings. When we think of the burning of Washington, we sort of think of the Washington of the Civil War, where it had grown. It was still pretty much country. When you look around the Capitol, there was, you know, meadows.
Yeah, it was really a village with these remarkable public edifices that had been built, like the Capitol and the White House. It was about 8,000 people at that time, sort of scattered around in just muddy roads and fields and cows and corn. But it was being built as this permanent American monument, and buildings like the Capitol was the most spectacular, magnificent building in America at this time. And the British, the fires that they lit that night, that very night that they captured Washington, were just remarkable. I mean, they could be viewed from dozens of miles away, 40, 45 miles away. People could see the night sky glowing, and the Washington Navy Yard was in flames with all the tar and timber and ships down there. It was just a spectacle that people who saw it would never forget.
How did Americans react to the burning of Washington? Did they feel like, well, this is it, or did that become a rallying point?
Well, I think initially there was a lot of just complete panic, and there was a fear that this panic was of capitulation was just going to spread and the whole country was in danger of collapsing. Certainly everybody feared Baltimore could be next, and if Baltimore went, which was then the third largest city in America, then Philadelphia and New York might not be far behind. So this initial panic, though, becomes more or less superseded with a growing sense of outrage, particularly when it's learned that the British had burned, for example, the Library of Congress, all the books that were at that time in the Capitol building. And I think there was a general sense of outrage and defiance that began to build, and particularly because the British delayed before attacking Baltimore, there was time for more militia to muster and to head into Baltimore to try to defend that city.
And, that same thing happened in the Revolution. The British would be on the verge of destroying the United States and Americans, and they would sort of dither for a while. And this is the same thing happened in Baltimore. They waited 6 weeks, and then they attacked in a horrible storm.
Right. Well, yeah, it was, of course, Admiral Coburn, who we spoke about earlier, was eager to attack immediately, and so were some of the other British commanders. But the admiral in charge of the forces in the Chesapeake, Admiral Cochrane, was reluctant. He wanted to save the forces to go attack New Orleans, and then so refused at first, and then dithered for a few weeks before deciding, well, you know what, we might as well attack Baltimore now. And by that point, the Americans had a good chance to defend the city.
Your description of Cochrane was great. It says his family was, they lied, they were too concerned with money, and they just couldn't be trusted. And somebody said about him, said, he generally, as a military leader, he had the right idea at the first time, but all these other ideas sort of swirled around, and he would muddy the waters and eventually come around to the original idea again. It was a very interesting description of him, and that's sort of what describes what happened in Baltimore. Of course, the story of the Star-Spangled Banner is sort of complex because Francis Scott Key is on a British ship. He's come to rescue a doctor named William Beanes, who had upset one of the generals because they had the general on the trip to Washington had given him parley, and he hosted him, and it was like, I'm not going to harm you as long as you don't harm us. And then later, as the British are retreating, this doctor goes out and starts trying to round up British stragglers, and this upsets Ross, so he has him arrested, and he brings him to the ship. This is how it all occurred, didn't it?
That's right, and this doctor happens to be a family friend of Francis Scott Key, and so some mutual friends approach him in Washington, and the city is still smoldering after being burned by the British. And Key, by virtue of being a well-connected attorney and connected with the government as well, is able to get permission from President Madison to launch this attempt to rescue Dr. Beanes, because it was feared he would never come back alive. He was elderly and not in great health. And Key launches this pretty remarkable adventure to go save Dr. Beanes, and ends up sailing out and joining the British fleet in the middle of the Chesapeake, and arrives at the fleet right at the moment when the British have finally decided to attack Baltimore. So he succeeds in his mission in that the British agree to release Dr. Beans, but then Key and the entire American delegation is told that, but by the way, you can't leave until we finish our attack on Baltimore. So Key becomes an unwilling witness to this attack that is being marshaled.
And, of course, how much of the story of that is true, of you know, the bombardment going on all night, the flag still waving in the wind, that inspired him to write this, the Star-Spangled Banner?
I don't think there's any question that all of it's true. This is a it's a very good description that first verse that he wrote that we sing at ball games and everywhere else is really one long question, and it describes quite well what Key witnesses and what's going on in that the British launch this. It's actually a dual attack, one force attacking by land and then a bombardment squadron attacking the fort, which the British need to take down in order to reach the city of Baltimore itself. And the British have some very powerful bomb ships that are firing hundreds and in fact, before it all ends, thousands of bombs and rockets at Fort McHenry. And it's just this ferocious bombardment that grows during the night. You know, Key had been able to see the flag flying in the twilight as the day progressed, but then at night you can no longer see the flag. But the continuing bombardment at least offered reassurance that the fort was still there. The flag was still over the fort, and Americans had not surrendered. But then, before dawn, everything goes quiet and Key and his companions are just beside themselves with anxiety, worried that this means that the Americans have surrendered and the British have taken Baltimore. And it's only with dawn, after this terrible night of storms and bombardment ends, as they're waiting for the mist to gather, that they're finally able to spot the American flag. And for Key, it was a very emotional moment, because at that time, he really wasn't sure if the American Republic was going to survive. It just seemed that the whole fate of the nation was at stake.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating look at the creation of that song and also of that summer, which sort of sealed American sovereignty, really. The name of the book is Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. Steve Vogel, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. My pleasure.
Washington Post national reporter Steve Vogel speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His latest book is titled Through the Perilous Fight, 6 Weeks That Saved the Nation. It's published by Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent episodes, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search through the Studio Tulsa archives for the show you're looking for. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.